If Zaire had China's protection, I would feel confident too. But Dan disagreed. China isn't strong enough to challenge the Soviet Union head-to-head, and the Russians can afford to be patient with Japan. They'll squeeze the smaller nations out first. They're already after Venezuela. Then, pointing to the men as he spoke, Zaire and Polynesia will be the easiest to pressure, then the Pan-Islam factories and India's. Noble cocked his head slightly to one side in a gesture that said, "So?"
"Once they've done that," Dan continued, "they can squeeze Japan gently but continuously, raise the price of raw materials, cut down on their supply. After all, they'll have all those newly acquired factories to feed, won't they? Yamagata's space operations will lose profitability. Your products will have to sell at higher prices than the competing products manufactured by the Russians. They'll use good old tried and true 19th century robber baron tactics on you, and it will work eventually. They can afford to operate at a deficit for as long as it takes. Yamagata can't." The young Japanese pursed his lips. "China will be the only other nation operating in space then," Dan said. "At that point, the Russians wouldn't be averse to using their muscle. They'll force China out of the game as part of their long-range plan for bringing China under Soviet control here on Earth."
"The Chinese have not dismantled their nuclear arsenal," Kolwezi pointed out. "Their missiles are still in their silos and still fully armed."
Dan felt his face freeze. With a conscious effort, he kept his voice calm and even as he said,
"If the Soviet anti-missile satellites were good enough to make the American nuclear deterrent useless, how much do you think they fear from the Chinese nuclear force?"
Al-Hashimi, holding his cigarette straight up between thumb and forefinger, agreed.
"Yes, the Russians still have their lasers in orbit. They can shoot down any missiles launched at them."
Chalon's usually cheerful Polynesian smile had disappeared long ago. Bleakly, he reminded them,
"Those lasers can also be used on our factories and space stations."
"That's a comforting thought," muttered Kolwezi.
"They would not dare," Babunia snapped.
"They wouldn't have to," said Dan. "They won't have to attack our facilities in space any more than they had to launch their missiles at the United States. Once you know that they can destroy you, and you have no way to defend yourself, they win. It's like chess. You don't fight to the last man once you've been checkmated."
"You believe, then," Al-Hashimi said, squinting through his cigarette's smoke, "that the Soviets will try to pressure us out of our space operations through economic and political means?"
"Right. This recent price increase of theirs is just the beginning. They have a monopoly on raw materials, and they're going to use it to squeeze the life out of us. That's why they illegally stole my asteroid spacecraft and imprisoned the crew. They will not allow anyone to upset their monopoly on raw materials, no matter what they have to do to protect it."
"Then what can we do?"
Babunia flapped his hands like a helpless man ready to give up.
"If they are determined to destroy us, they certainly have the power to do so."
"We fight back." The three words seemed to immobilize the five other men at the table. For a long moment, they sat as if frozen. Chalons looking desperately unhappy, Al-Hashimi grimly amused, Babunia frightened, Kolwezi plainly disgusted with the state of affairs Dan was predicting, Nobuhiko more curious and expectant than anything else. Al-Hashimi broke the silence.
"Fight back against laser-armed satellites and nuclear missiles with what?"
"Our wits," replied Dan.
"Explain what you mean," Kolwezi requested.
Dan said, "The Russians aren't supermen. They have weaknesses. The raid on Luna Grot showed that they can be surprised and overpowered by even a very small group of men, if those men are determined enough.
And now the Soviets are stationing a battalion of armed troops at Luna Grot," said Al-Hashimi in a bored, sardonic tone.
Dan grinned at him. "There's almost a quarter of a million miles between our factories and the moon. Dozens of Russian ore freighters trundle back and forth across that distance every day. They are unmanned and unprotected."
"What are you saying?" Babunia gasped.
"According to my lawyer's reading of the international regulations, the ore in those freighters does not belong to the Soviet Union. It does not belong legally to any nation. Those resources are, and I quote from the law, the common heritage of all humankind. Dan smiled broadly at them. In other words, gentlemen, they are ours for the taking. Chalons laughed. Al-Hashimi snorted impatiently and stubbed out his cigarette in the stainless steel ashtray that had been set at his place. Babunia said, "But we cannot simply take the ores out of the Soviet freighters." "Why not?" Dan countered. "The Soviet Union does not own the ores. Legally, they can be used by any nation which can obtain them. The fact that we pay the Russians to dig them up from the moon and bring them to our factories does not give them title to the stuff. Legally, we're merely paying them for transporting the raw materials to us." "But they would never..." Dan silenced him with a curt gesture. "The Russians themselves are using that argument in the World Court against Astro Manufacturing. They claim that the asteroid material my spacecraft was carrying did not legally belong to Astro, and they had a perfect right to confiscate it." "Ah," said Colwazy, "there's a difference. Astro Manufacturing is a private corporation. It isn't a nation. The law does not allow private corporations the same protections that it gives to nations." "It's a tricky legal point," Dan admitted. "But each of us operates under the banner of a sovereign nation. Why shouldn't Zaire or India or Japan go out and take the ores we need for our factories?" "Because the Russians would use their lasers to destroy our factories," Chalons said. "Or they would guard their freighters," suggested Novo. "There are 100 ways they could stop us," Al-Hashimi said. "Maybe," said Dan. "But they'd have to exert themselves. They'd have to use force of one kind or another. They'd have to show the world and the world court that they are using their power against the best interests of the smaller, independent nations." Babunia blinked his big brown liquid eyes. "I see. I understand. The Soviets would be in the position of obviously bullying the other nations. World opinion would be marshaled against them."
"Right."
"Since when has world opinion bothered them?" Al-Hashimi countered disdainfully. "Especially when their vital interests are at stake." "All I'm saying," Dan urged, "is that we can make it tough for them to squeeze us out of space. We can raise their costs so high that they'll stop trying to get rid of us. We can't overturn the Soviet Union, I know that, but we can prevent them from ruining us if we act boldly enough."
"At the risk of having our factories destroyed and our nations threatened with nuclear retaliation?" Colwazy asked.
Dan grinned at him. "You wouldn't be sitting at this table if you hadn't taken some risks during your life."
"True," the Zairean admitted, "but it's this, or we're finished. The Russians are moving to push us out of space entirely. You know that."
From the far end of the table, Novo asked, "You, sir, have already been personally threatened by Soviet actions. Two persons have been murdered, and it seems likely that you are marked for assassination by the KGB. Wouldn't it be easier for the Soviets to counter any moves we make by eliminating us as individuals?"
Dan looked down the length of the table at his old friend's son.
"None of us is exactly defenseless on the personal level, and I think that the murders have a personal motivation, not a political one."
"Still, no course of action is without risks," Dan said. "Personal as well as corporate and national."
"You are asking us to commit piracy," Al-Hashimi said.
"The Russians will call it piracy," Dan admitted cheerfully, "but we have strong legal arguments to the contrary."
"They'll seize our factories," Chalons insisted, "or blow them to pieces."
"Not if they don't know which factories to attack," said Dan. "For God's sake, we're not going to advertise what we're doing. There are 6 factory complexes in orbit, 7 if we can bring the Chinese into this. The Russians can't attack them all. And surely we're smart enough to keep them guessing as to who's doing what to whom."
"They'll protect their freighters, put guards aboard, or escort them with armed spacecraft."
"In time," Dan admitted, "maybe they will. But it will cost them a fortune. It'd be much easier for them to negotiate a lower price for the ores."
Novo mused.
"They would have a difficult time protecting every freighter all the time. That would tie up hundreds of men, perhaps thousands."
Al-Hashimi turned his sardonic smile toward Dan.
"And it would reflect very poorly on the new chief of their space programs."
Dan grinned back at him.
"Yes, it might at that."
Tapping both his hands on the tabletop, Babunia said enthusiastically,
"After all, the ores are very certainly the common property of all humankind. We have as much right to them as anyone."
Are you all